That's the Russian national anthem, introducing us to another episode here of Conservative Casual Friday with your show host, Andrew Herod, where we like to discuss current events of the day for conservatives and others. And today we would like to discuss the recent arrest on January 17th of Alexei Navalny at a Moscow airport, an important Russian political opposition figure against the regime of President Vladimir Putin there today. And to discuss this important issue and the future of Russia's politics and any efforts at democratic reform, we have once again Aaron Korowa, the program manager for the McCain Institute, who is an expert on Nordic and East European security, about which he writes. He's previously joined us on the show to discuss issues in Belarus last August following their rigged election. So we want to discuss Russia and its political future today. Welcome to the show, Aaron.
Thank you for having me.
Well, first of all, starting out, tell our listeners here, who is Alexei Navalny?
So Alexei Navalny is a Russian opposition leader, politician, lawyer by training, anti-corruption activist, and blogger. He's in many ways probably the most famous leader of the Russian opposition at this point. He has a YouTube channel which has more than 6 million subscribers and about 2 million Twitter followers. He started out his career basically as a anti-corruption activist. And of course, corruption is in many ways the issue in Russia. As many opposition people have often said, corruption is not it's a feature of the system. It's not a bug. The current regime of Vladimir Putin basically relies on these kind of patron-client networks of a kleptocracy where the vast resources of the country are basically divided up among a small little group of Putin-loyal oligarchs. What that does is that it allows the regime to control the flows of money in Russia. And of course, Russia is a country of vast natural resources, primarily oil and gas, but there are other things as well. Allows the regime to, you know, keep the big oligarchs loyal to it. But of course, that kind of, it hinders growth and development, and it means that the people are basically left with scraps. And so Alexei Navalny has been leading this campaign of exposing the corruption and the luxurious lifestyle of the political elite in Russia for quite a long time. Back in 2017, he did a huge expose on then Russian Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev, which he basically described how the man has one of his pretty luxurious residences where he basically had a nice big pool with for his ducks. And of course, Navalny is very good at like finding these like rather absurd pools of this corruption. He also exposed another prominent political figure that flew his dog to a dog show on a private jumbo jet somewhere, a dog show, and I believe it was somewhere in Europe. I think it was France maybe, or maybe Italy, I don't remember. But it was just an example of showing, you know, how, what kind of a lifestyle these people allow themselves to have in a country where about 20 million of Russia's roughly 142 million inhabitants are hovering on the poverty line. That drives home the message just how extremely rigged the system in Russia is these days. And of course, that finds itself an audience. In 2013, he ran for mayor of Moscow and came in second with 27% of the vote, losing to the incumbent Sergei Sobyanin, who is a Putin appointee, which is very impressive considering that, there, of course, election systems in Russia are rigged as well. Now, unlike Belarus that we talked about last time, Belarus is just an open dictatorship, not shy about it. Russia today prefers this kind of system that pretends to be a democracy but isn't really. Like they would allow sometimes opposition candidates, but they are severely limited as to, you know, their ability to campaign, for example, and stuff like that. Often opposition candidates are barred at the very last second before the election, so that, you know, they're not actually able to run in a free and fair way. For a while, we've seen these examples of Russian opposition leaders getting poisoned. And of course, people were long thinking about, like, is this going to happen to Navalny? And unfortunately, in August last year, that's actually what happened. On a plane ride from Siberia to Moscow, Navalny fell very ill. The pilot did an emergency landing, and he was taken to a hospital in Germany and was discovered that it was, in fact, Novichok, this nerve agent that is common among what you would say Russian security services using against other enemies of the regime. This happened to the Litvinenko, the former spy who defected many years ago. And this was also, of course, what they tried to use against the Sergei and Yulia Skripal in Salisbury in England not that long ago. So it followed a reasonable pattern. When Navalny woke up from his coma, seemingly undeterred by this, he instead decided to go after the regime. So working with the excellent English investigative firm Bellingcat, he helped expose his would-be assassins within the FSB, the Russian security services. He even went so far as to call one of them up on the phone, and pretending to be his superior prompted the guy to confess to the crime, which is extremely ballsy. You might want to call that. He got the guy to describe how the plot was actually going to work, which included the FSB. They apparently laced the inside of Navalny's underwear with this nerve agent, which of course prompted many Russians who are famous for their dark humor to say, I've never heard of Alexei Navalny, but he must be a really important guy. The security services are handling his underwear. Haha. That's the joke. That's what we call dark humor in Russia. They're experts in this field. And so as soon as he woke up from the coma, he immediately said that he is going to go back to Russia. And this is the kind of attitude he shows, you know, completely fearless. He's a Russian politician. He has to be in Russia. Once he bought a ticket, you know, ordinary plane. He told his supporters to come and show up and, cheer him on when he lands. Of course, the pilot told everybody that we're going to divert for technical reasons. That's usually the thing that's being told in Russia when, you know, something's up, they would say technical reasons. They diverted the plane away from the first airport to a smaller airport so that, you know, missing the crowds. And as soon as he landed, he was arrested on the spot. This arrest was supposedly for violating parole on a suspended sentence when he was in Germany in a coma after being poisoned, which sort of shows you the absurdity of the Russian justice system these days. You get arrested for violating parole on a suspended sentence because you were lying in a coma in another country. So that's how it looks like. And again, what does he do? He gets arrested, he gets put in prison. He just decides to slap the regime in the face yet again by releasing this two-hour video called A Palace for Putin, which basically, using information leaked to him from the people who worked on it, gives off this image of this gigantic palace on the Black Sea coast, prime real estate in Russia. It's like 17,500 square meters in size, costs ostensibly at $1.5 billion. It basically makes Mar-a-Lago look, you know, like a little shack. You know what I'm saying? That kind of stuff. Built for Vladimir Putin himself. Which is extremely interesting because previously Navalny would go for other members of the regime. You know, Dmitry Medvedev, he was the prime minister, was not a very popular guy. This time he went straight for Vladimir Putin, which again, you know, if you're in Russia and, you know, you go after Vladimir Putin in this way, that shows you have guts, to put it mildly. This video has now been viewed, I think, 100 million times. It's impossible to tell if it's like by 100 million people in Russia or in general, but 100 million times. And from the prison, he has called for protests in Russia. We have now seen protests in over 100 different cities, from the metropolitan Moscow and St. Petersburg all the way to Yakutsk in Siberia, where the people were defining, you know, freezing temperatures of like minus 50 degrees or something like that, because that's what you get in Russia this time of the year. And this is basically where we are. Also, Navalny was clever enough to say before he went into prison that through his lawyers that I don't intend to commit suicide, which of course is kind of like this, you know, by the way, if I end up dead, we all know why. right? I didn't commit suicide, because that's usually the, you know, the explanation for what happens. Like, oh yeah, unfortunate accident, or, you know, something like that. But he was like, by the way, I did not do that. So that's where we are.
Well, interesting. Yeah, so you mentioned he was arrested on his January 17th return after his plane was diverted to another airport in Moscow from the main airport. The Russian authorities were trying to head off any sort of planned protest welcoming him, was what the media was commenting on. But then Navalny himself, this anti-corruption campaigner in Russia, he's then this arrest occurred because of this sort of absurd claim of violating his parole while he was in a coma in Berlin in the hospital there after being flown out of Russia following his poisoning. This then stems from a 2012 or 2013 corruption charge. Is Navalny himself corrupt, or is that just the European Court of Human Rights and others have said, have judged that this was just trumped up charges?
Yeah, no, they were trumped up charges. I mean, he has, I think he has won around 6 complaints against the Russian authorities in the European Court for Human Rights. This is a fairly typical tactic that's used in Russia. Ever goes back to the Soviet times, where the authorities basically accuse the people or exposing them for a crime, for the same kind of crime, you know, in order to divert attention. In some ways, and so yeah, those. I mean, the sentence that he was on the suspended sentence that he was on violating supposing his parole was a sentence that the European Court for Human Rights also overturned. So that sort of adds to the whole absurdity of it all, of putting him in prison right now. But yeah, that's again, that's the Russian justice system for you.
Oh, and let's see. Is Russia now, they've then signed a statute with the European Court of Human Rights that they're subject to its jurisdiction?
Well, they recently withdrew from that, but that was after the sentence the court overturned the sentences with Navalny. So, I mean, Russia, you know, they like having it both ways. The recent constitution in Russia, which they just had a referendum, and again I will say referendum in air quotes because it was not a free and fair one, that it outlines that Russia is going to withdraw, is not going to be subject to any kind of jurisdiction than the one in Russia. But that was fairly recently.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I mean, you mentioned the issue of Navalny's bravery. Why did he decide to return now on January 17th to Russia? People had actually warned him against going back.
Well, because he understands that if he stays out, Putin has won, basically. I mean, that's what Putin hopes for, to drive out every single opposition leader outside of Russia. That's his goal. And people who are close to Navalny say that, you know, he was really, really mad at Putin for trying to poison him. I have never experienced Novichok, but there is a video of what happens to Navalny on the plane, where he basically starts screaming in agony when the poison starts taking effect. So that's not a pleasant experience in any way. And so Navalny is just the kind of guy who, like, you know, you go after him, he wants to get even. He said openly, you know, people asked him if he's afraid. He said, you know, I'm not afraid, and nobody should be afraid. And that's kind of like what he's going for here, you know, break the spell. If you're scared, well, then the regime has, you know, the upper hand. If you're not scared, if you see through it, then, you know, then the regime is on the defensive.
Yeah. So Navalny, he was poisoned on August 20th last year, on a flight from Tomsk in Siberia, I believe, back home to Moscow. Why did the regime apparently decide to take action against him at that time?
Well, it could be sometimes hard, you know, to get into Putin's head and the regime's head. I think that in many ways, you could say that they're sort of drinking their own Kool-Aid at this point. The circle of advisors around Putin has gotten smaller and smaller. The sort of the main backbone of the regime right now is a group of people known as the Shiloviki, which means basically the strong men. They're all former KGB agents, just like Putin himself, and they sort of think like that. Possible that they believe that, well, you know, if he drops dead in Russia, you know, what's the West going to do about it, basically? A typical propaganda line that the Russian regime uses is that, well, Navalny is not actually that popular in Russia, right? They would often point to these opinion polls where you match up Navalny with Putin and Navalny only gets a few percent, like in a presidential election. Now, of course, again, we're talking about Russia. Russia is not a free country. So if you ask your average person in Russia, you know, would you vote for Putin or would you vote for this other guy? A lot of Russians would just say Putin I'm happy with the devil I have, you know, better the devil you know than the one you don't know, in that kind of sense. And also, you know, you in a country like Russia, somebody calls you up and says, do you support the president, yes or no? People are sort of inclined to say yes. Again, this goes back, you know, back in history. So it's possible that they simply believe that, well, you know, they believe their own propaganda that, you know, he's not actually that popular or that important. So, you know, we can get rid of him. And, you know, yes, people are going to say, oh, it was probably the FSB who poisoned him. And they will just do what they've always done every time they've been exposed, which is just deny, and throw out a bunch of, you know, nonsense and see if it sticks and if people believe it.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. There has been, you indicate, there has been some suggestions in the past that he actually isn't that popular or the opposition really doesn't support him. Is there any merit to that? What is his role in the opposition in Russia?
Well, the opposition in Russia is, I mean, it is unfortunately divided. I can add to the previous question that it's important to note is that Navalny was really, really getting under the regime's skin also, because aside from his activism and his anti-corruption videos, he had also started something that he calls the smart vote strategy, which basically is the way the voting works. Russia uses the majority voting system in most places. And the current ruling party, United Russia, which is basically just Putin's party, that's like, you know, do whatever Putin wants. That's their program. They rely on this fact that the opposition is divided because they don't need a majority to win in most districts. They just need to be, you know, the biggest party, because the biggest party wins. So what Navalny has done is he started this smart vote strategy, which basically is going to all these parts of Russia. That's why he was in Siberia at the time and went flying back, and calling on people to just vote for anyone except the United Russia candidate. I mean, it doesn't matter if it's like someone from the official Liberal Democrat Party, which is a far right party. They're not actual Liberal Democrats, or even the Communist Party, or like someone who doesn't have a party, anybody, just so you know, so that the United Russia Party cannot control the Duma, the parliament. And that's something that really, really made the regime nervous. In terms of his popularity within the Russian opposition movement, I mean, there are some parties that are sort of, you know, worried about the fact that he previously expressed views that may be considered very nationalistic. And this is a complicated subject in Russia in many ways. But he has been a member of other parties. The first party he was a member of is a party called Yabloko, which means apple. And it's like a very, very liberal, socially liberal party with very like pro-Western values. And he left that party. So there's possible that there's some bad blood there. In terms of, you know, some people who have really, really have issues with him. When we talk about nationalism in Russia, it's very important to remember that, like, saying words like nationalist is usually a way that the regime does in order to discredit people. But it's not because that they don't like nationalism. Nationalism is that the Putin regime is basically imperialist. I mean, they want to restore Russia to its great imperial past, and they believe that nationalism, it undermines the message of the empire, right? Because if you're a nationalist, it's like, well, then you want Russia for Russians, and you would want, you know, Chechnya for Chechens, and I don't know, like Tatarstan for Tatars, and so on. And well, of course, if you do that, the empire will disintegrate. It's important to note that even after the fall of the Soviet Union, you know, there are still plenty of minorities living in Russia. And, you know, there and the republics in Russia that are, you know, for a minority group. So that's sort of what Putin fears. So the word, the meaning of the word nationalism, the whole thing about nationalism is a little bit different in Russia than it is in the West. It's also what, when it comes to things like, for example, his statements on Ukraine and Crimea. I mean, there are a lot of people in Ukraine who have issues with Navalny. I think that the way he talks about this is, of course, that when Crimea was seized, this was a very popular move in Russia. So if you're a Russian oppositionist and you're fighting against this very strong and capable regime, it's probably not a good idea to go out and say something that would make you extremely unpopular in Russia. So I think it might also be a tactic.
Well, that's an interesting issue of the definition of nationalism. What are the feelings then in Russia about such nationalism and about Russia's role in the world? So you're saying that nationalism is often interpreted in Russia to mean that, maybe you might compare it like to the debates over Little England in the past and in the United Kingdom, that, nationalism is interpreted as, lets us Russians just kind of stay home and, avoid any kind of involvement, entanglements with other regions, other peoples, whereas Putin is playing up this idea of we're going to be a great Russian power again and have dominance over this area of the former Russian Empire. And also that, nationalists, you're suggesting that they're maybe advocating for more of like an autonomous federal regime in Russia where you would have more independence for these non-Russian populations and sort of less Russian control over them.
Well, yeah, that's the interesting thing. The official title of the Russian state is the Russian Federation. That's the official title of the country. But, of course, it's not a federal country in terms of, like, the United States. There is no actual federalism. There are all these republics, but everything is run, from Moscow and by Putin, basically. So Navalny has previously talked about his support for federalism. Now, he has been a little vague and unclear on how exactly that's going to look like. But I mean, if you are actual federalist, then you would support these other Russian republics, these other republics within Russia to run their own affairs. Going back to what I said with the problem of the word nationalism in Russia is, of course, that, I mean, the previous name of the country was the Soviet Union, right? The word Russia wasn't used. So today when people say, well, if you're a citizen of Russia, say, well, you're Russian, as in you're a citizen of Russia. But of course, the word Russian also has an ethnic connotation. The Brits solved this matter by having, Great Britain. So you would say you're British or you're English, right? That's or you can say you're both British and English if you're English and support a United Kingdom, or you're Scottish and British or something like that. Whereas in Russia, that's of course harder because it's the same word. It's Russian and Russian. Like how do you separate that? So that's an issue in the country, which they have still debates on. I mean, of course, the problem is that when the Soviet Union fell apart, there was no Boris Yeltsin, who was the first president of the post-Soviet Russia. I mean, he even issued a commission with professors and historians to decide, like, what is Russia? Is Russia a nation state, or is it an empire, or what is it? What should be this new Russian national identity? And unfortunately, because the country isn't free, they haven't been able to have a clear and open debate about this topic. What is clear is that Putin is not a nationalist, insofar as I said before, that he is an imperialist. He wants this Russia to be this great power that not only controls its own territory, but also has all these other former Soviet republics within what you would call Russia's sphere of influence. So he doesn't like nationalism as in, to each nation its own state. He, of course, doesn't have any problem whatsoever to use Russian national symbols, but he does that as a way to promote the empire. That's his view of it. Of course, you might wonder, it's like, well, if a guy is not a nationalist, then why does he start wars of aggression against other countries in order to steal their territory? But that's part of the imperialism. When Putin says that he's going to defend the rights of Russian speakers outside the borders of Russia, that's exactly the point. He's referring to Russian speakers. But if you speak Russian, maybe you're not ethnically Russian, but you speak Russian, well, then you're part of this great empire, this Ruski Mir, as they call it, the Russian world, and you should be in Moscow's fold, so to speak. So that goes for every country where people speak Russian, even if they'd have not to be ethnically Russians. A good example of that is South Ossetia in Georgia that Russia seized in the Russia-Georgian war back in 2008, which basically the people who lived there, the Ossetians, there are Persian people. There are related to Iranians in terms of ethnicity, but they speak Russian, whereas the Russians are, of course, a Slavic people. But so since the Ossetians speak Russian, well, in that case, they are part of this Russian world that should be run by Moscow, not by Georgia.
Oh, interesting. I never realized that of the South Ossetia in Georgia, that they're actually a Persian background. How did they end up speaking Russian? That's interesting.
Well, part because of the Russian imperialism. I mean, the South Ossetia, the population is very small. I mean, if we look at the Caucasus, I mean, the Caucasus is literally a territory about the size of Spain, and it has like 50 different ethnic groups and languages in there. So what happened historically, this territory was fought over between the Persian Empire, the Ottoman Empire, and eventually the Russian Empire came in, beat the Persians and the Ottomans and took it over. And of course, this was in the 1800s and 19th century. So the influence of Russian imperialism during Tsarist times, then during the Soviet Union, left its mark. I mean, it's sort of similar to you know, a lot of people speaking English while not being English. It's a similar phenomenon. It's just that the Russian Empire was territorially linked. They didn't do overseas colonies the way the Brits did.
Right. Yeah, interesting. Well, looking at Navalny and his poisoning, you mentioned the Sergei Skripal case in 2018 in Salisbury, England. He and his wife apparently were poisoned. And actually, an English woman there was exposed to the Novichok poison and died. How common is this? What sort of measures does Putin use to harass his opponents, or stop his opponents, like poisonings or imprisonments or... what's the whole broad panoply, and what's the history of what Putin's done to his opponents?
Well, there's a broad panoply of these things. So historically, the Novichok and the poisoning started, of course, the first case of this under Putin was with the defector Alexander Litvinenko. And I must confess that I don't recall the exact year when that happened. I believe it was... But this was like, I think it was 2006. So this was like a long time ago, you know, during the time when Western powers still sort of believed that Putin might be a reformer in Russia. That tactic is often used against former agents who defected. Skripal was, of course, also such an agent that the Russian government thought that, well, he defected, he was part of a swap, but that he was working with the Brits. So it's kind of a way of, you know, scaring people abroad and scaring people who used to be part of the intelligence community that Putin has, because he was a former KGB agent himself. He has a special fondness for the intelligence community. So it would be like he wants to scare what he sees as traitors in that way. And of course, the thing about Novichok and in Litvinenko's case, just remember, it wasn't Novichok, it was polonium. Which is also a chemical weapon, but the point of that is that it's you know, you don't see it, you can't notice it until it's too late, until you're basically dead. So it has this kind of like a you know, you can never know if you're safe. So it's kind of the scare tactic. There are other ways. I mean, of course, it's the case of the former prime minister, deputy prime minister Boris Nemtsov, who was shot just outside the Kremlin. That is most likely, most people point to that was the work of Ramzan Kadyrov, who is the ruler of Chechnya, which, of course, is a republic within the Russian Federation, run, of course, nominally by Moscow, but where Kadyrov basically has its own little operation going. And that thing was... It's kind of what you could call like plausible deniability. It's still unclear whether or not Putin actually ordered that assassination or whether Kadyrov acted on his own, but at least it's something that people do in order to please the big boss, Putin, in this case. What people often make mistake about Putin is that Putin is not a guy who sort of, the way this operates is that he's not a person who sits there every day and goes like, okay, kill this person, kill that person. Ever since Joseph Stalin, the regime in Russia hasn't really like directly said, we need to kill this guy. They would say something to the effect of, well, this guy is a problem, right? Something like that. And then people would know what that means. You know, kind of like the Shakespeare thing, you know, would somebody rid me of this troublesome priest, but meaning it, right? Not meaning it. So What he does, what the regime does, is that it sort of tells the security services that, you know, this person is a problem, and then they allow the security services to do their thing, and if they screw up, as in this case with Navalny, well, then the regime provides cover for it. They don't, you know, there is no such thing as now we're going to do an independent investigation or, an independent council in Russia to look into, did the security service do this? No, like the regime just provides cover for them and says like, well, that it wasn't us, it's Western propaganda, blah, 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 forget about it, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, the polonium case, I remember, I guess that was, I'm trying to recall the date on that. That was in London in 2006. With the individual, say, Litvinenko. And all these assassinations, of course, talking about the KGB and Vladimir Putin, there's a long history there. And going back to the Cold War, you had, the famous London Bridge case of the Bulgarian dissident defector in 1978 who was stabbed with a KGB agent, hit him with a... or Bulgarian
umbrella.
Agent help, yeah, umbrella, right, that
umbrella,
had a,
yes.
had a sort of a hypodermic needle in and put in a poison into him, and ultimately he died a couple of weeks later in hospital. And, of course, John le Carré, in his Smiley's People novel, begins with KGB assassinating a defector in London Park. There's a long history there. You said the former Latvian prime minister was killed just outside of the Kremlin, was shot?
No, sorry. The Boris Nemtsov, the deputy prime minister of Russia, former deputy prime minister of Russia. Boris Nemtsov was shot in, I believe, again, I get my dates wrong a lot sometimes, but he was shot in, I think it was somewhere around 2015. I believe it was, yes, 2015 or slightly before that. Boris Nemtsov was a former deputy prime minister of Russia under Yeltsin, who became a very prominent opposition figure. And he criticized also the corruption of the Putin regime and the dangers of the Putin regime. And he was working on a film that exposed Russia's invasion of Ukraine and the crimes that were committed there. And, of course, this was 2014, 2015, when the war in Ukraine started. And this was, of course, an extremely sensitive subject in Russia. Boris Nemtsov would often say that, I'm too famous. They will never dare to kill me. And unfortunately, he was wrong. They did. He was shot just outside of the Kremlin. For some reason, the cameras were not working that day. The security cameras were, for some reason, not working. It's surprising how that seems to happen every time when something is affront. Boris Nemtsov was a great man, and unfortunately, this is the. So it's important to know one thing also, that the current Russian regime, as I said before, like they are not an open dictatorship like Belarus. They want to keep this kind of facade of being a quote unquote normal country. I mean, the last thing Putin wants is to be compared to Kim Jong-un, for example, right? So like, mm-hmm. Like a cartoony dictator figure, he wants this legitimacy. So they don't rely on their way of controlling the population is not like mass terror under Stalin. It's mostly like apathy, right? They're sort of saying that there is no alternative to Putin. If an alternative comes up, like Nemtsov or in this case Navalny, well, they try to get rid of that person. But they don't go around like poisoning ordinary Russians left, right, and center. It's more like, well, you're stuck with this guy. You're stuck with Vladimir Putin. If it's not Vladimir Putin, then there's going to be chaos, like in the 90s. You don't want that. That's sort of their message to the people. Every time there's a protest like we're seeing right now, they're just trying to wear them out. That's the go-to tactic that they're using.
Well, looking at these elections, if we could call them that, you mentioned before Navalny's 2013 run for the mayorship in Moscow, where, as you indicated, he won 27% of the vote, coming in second, even though he apparently worked under enormous obstacles, like not having access to state-run media. What are sort of the means by which Putin tries to stay in power during these elections? Like, what's the opposition facing if they ever try to go up against Putin's United Russia Party in, say, running for the mayorship in Moscow or anywhere else, any other office in Russia?
Well, it kind of varies. Russia is a very big country, and of course, it varies a little bit from part to part. Like the big cities in Moscow and St. Petersburg, because they are very, there are a lot of people, a lot of urban-minded professionals and stuff like that, educated people. So the authorities really try to avoid doing election steals that are like too obvious and too open. One thing, like I said before, what the United Russia Party relies on is this first sort of forced past the post system, where the party with the most votes wins everything, even if they're not, bigger, even if they don't have 50% of the vote, they still take the whole district. There's been a lot of gerrymandering. If you look at the region of Moscow, they've expanded they call it the city of Moscow, but it includes a lot of more rural areas around it where Putin's support is more solid. He tends to have more support among the rural and urban poor and less educated older people. That's his usual support base. They also do like all right stealing, ballot stuffing and stuff like that, and often in these more remote places where there's less monitoring and less media that can come and hold them to account. It varies a little bit. I mean, again, the regime prefers to not to do this too openly in order not to get not to get caught. They know that the people, most people in Russia understand that the elections aren't free and fair, but they don't like when it's openly stolen, right in their face kind of thing, which is why, we have to look at the upcoming Duma elections, parliamentary elections in September this year, because the recent referendum and presidential election, which granted, Putin more time to sit in power. Part of the messaging there was very much let's get together for a great leader for Putin and, better times are ahead. But of course, the same kind of coming up with the same kind of enthusiasm when things are really not that great in Russia these days is going to be hard. So that gives the opposition some advantages. The problem is, of course, the opposition is still divided, but we might see something different right now after these recent events with Navalny. That's it's the long game, right? The regime tries to play the long game. The opposition needs to play the long game as well.
Well, as recently reported in the reporting on Navalny, I've noted that the opposition last year in 2020 they had won the majority in three urban city legislative councils. How did that happen? What does that say about the opposition that they've obtained certain victories?
Well, it says for one thing is that the tact they're getting, they're getting better with their tactics, and the regime's message to the people is getting weaker and weaker. Putin often relies on this whole thing that if it's not me and my party, then you're going back to the chaos of the 90s. Well, the problem with that is that you have a lot of young people in Russia these days who don't remember the 90s. The only thing they remember is Putin. And they look around and they say, well, why are we stuck with this guy and his party anyway? Like, why can we not vote for somebody else? They get a lot of their the regime has been doing an active campaign and trying to control the media mainly through television. But today, most young people get their news not from – it's not that they don't believe Russian state television. They just don't watch it anymore. They get their news from YouTube and social media, which the opposition has a much bigger presence. Russia is, of course, not China. The regime cannot regulate social media the way that they do in China. One of the benefits of the 90s was this sort of small window of freedom in Russia, where a lot of these things were put in place that the regime now has a very hard time rolling back. So the opposition is simply it is gaining, and it is basically learning better tactics to work against the regime in many ways.
Well, talk about Putin's support. You mentioned the sort of divides between sort of younger and older and urban and rural. What is the nature of Putin's appeal and his support base versus that of the opposition?
A lot of that, again, is this kind of like the Putin's support is what you would call it's not deep. It's a very shallow form of support. It's kind of like this, well, again, like better with the guy, Because if we, if, you know, if we change everything, start changing everything. Historically in Russia, when you start changing stuff, like everything falls apart, and then, you know, a lot of bad things happen. Like after the Soviet Union fell apart, you know, people didn't get their salary, they didn't get their pensions, they lost their jobs, a lot of chaos, gangsters, you know, that kind of stuff. So they're like, you know what, let's just stick with the guy we know. At least I get my pension on time. At least I get my salary on time, and you know, and that's all I need. And of course, like the part of like make Russia great again, make Russia great and respected is not lost. There are a lot of people in Russia who believe in that and who think that, you know, Russia was disrespected after the fall of the Soviet Union because it was no longer a great power. Of course, unfortunately, the way Russians define great power usually means, you know, the right to control other countries, which is where the conflict with other countries tends to come from. But also, yeah, I mean, it's mainly that. And it's kind of like, you know, the sense of stability and predictability. And for a while that worked. I mean, especially when the oil prices were high, even if Putin and his cronies stole a lot of the money, and the people were left with scraps, then at least those scraps were better than nothing, which is what they had, you know, in the many people had pretty much nothing in the early 90s. So that was a fine trade-off. But of course, that doesn't work anymore. At this point, the oil prices are of course much lower than they were in the early 2000s. And in addition to that, like the corruption is everywhere. It's visible everywhere. The only thing that Putin has going for him is kind of like this make Russia great again thing. That sort of worked after Crimea was seized in 2014. That sort of led to this little sugar rush where, you know, the support for Putin jumped into really, really high levels. But that's gone down as well, because at this point people are like, okay, so we have Crimea, but so what? I mean, recent reports show that Crimea costs Russia vast sums of money. So it's like, okay, well, so we have Crimea, but we have to spend all this money on it. What's the benefit, really, if you think about it? There's, again, with the dark humor, you would always say like, oh, well, you know, the potholes, you know, in my street, there are still potholes all over the street in my hometown, like, but we still have Crimea, or like about 20% of the Russian people lack proper indoor plumbing, but we still have Crimea. And it's like, well, how long can you go with that? I mean, that was like, what is it, 7 years ago, like the novelty has sort of worn off.
Yeah. And so on the other hand, are younger Russians, are they more worldly, more wealthy, better educated? Is there a real generational change there from the past?
Well, I mean, Russia, of course, is a big country there. You know, there are a lot of different people there. It's hard, of course, to just make it, you know, young, old divide. But in general, Russia has a good educational system. Young people are smart. They're capable. They, you know, they know about the world. Russia is not the Soviet Union. You know, like, it's not like they're closing their people out. Like, the, you know, young Russian people travel around the world. They see other parts of the world. And they're a lot of them. That's why they go for Navalny. They're like, we just want this country to be a normal country. You know, we don't want this. We're tired of this corruption, all this repression, and things not going anywhere. You know, we're tired of the fact that we don't have roads or plumbing, whereas Putin can build himself a giant palace on the Black Sea coast. Like, why should we have to put up with this? So they're connected with the world in a different kind of way, and this is just not good enough for them anymore.
You mentioned an interesting point that internet and social media apparently is relatively free in Russia as it compared to the sort of classic case that we all hear about China, that China is really cracking down on any sort of internet activity, trying to control that and shut off that as any sort of avenue for outside influence upon China. Why has the media stayed relatively free in Russia, and would the Russian government ever act against that?
Well, during the 90s, well, sort of these building blocks, I mean, of course, there was no internet in the early 90s, but these building blocks for free internet were set, and there were a lot of like independent media channels that were started. So what the regime has been trying to do is to take over the independent media and the TV stations, because that's what their constituents, the older people, watch. Their tactic on social media has basically been to try to flood it, you know, with disinformation and stuff like that, not unlike the way that they're doing it abroad. The difference is that whereas, you know, most Russians are familiar with the disinformation lines used by the regime. So these kinds of, like, you know, flooding the social media space with nonsense doesn't work as well for the Russians domestically as it works in other countries, because most Russian people just see through that. They're familiar with the regime's lines and lies at this point.
Well, then, looking at this regime, how long do you think Putin has to last? I mean, I guess he's still in good health. And if Putin were ever to die or somehow fall, could anyone ever replace him in this kind of regime?
Well, that's the big million-dollar question, isn't it? Here's the thing about there. There are many, many important parts here. So according to the new constitution, Putin basically reset his term. I believe he can sit all the way to 2033, I believe it is, something like that, 2033. And yeah, I mean, he's in good health, Putin. So, you know, he's not like one of those aging Soviet dictators that, you know, when they dropped one after another in the 80s. So he could very well last that. The real thing about Russia today is that it's basically the regime. It's only Putin. There is no successor. I mean, during Tsarist times, it was very clear, right? There's a Tsar, there's a Tsarevich, the crown prince. That's the line of succession. In the Soviet Union, since Stalin, after Stalin, there was a system of succession. There was a party. Khrushchev was ousted by the party and replaced by Brezhnev. And the party, you know, put up the different lines of succession. Right now, there is no succession. That's one of the regime's problems. There's literally no one but Putin. And so the regime hasn't worked this out at all. And so that poses them with a real, real problem, because no one, of course, wants to stick out their neck for, you know, for fear of getting their head cut. And of course, Putin cannot give off the impression that he's leaving, because his entire power is based on this whole thing that he's the boss of the bosses, right? It's kind of like a mafia state way of thinking, that he's the toughest guy around. He's not going anywhere, so people have to, the other oligarchs and, you know, the other guys have to, like, listen to him. And as soon as it's sort of like, oh, he's leaving, he's a lame duck, well, you know, then things are going to start falling apart. It's basically like, well, if Putin picks up the phone and calls to you, you have to listen. But if Putin steps down and picks up the phone and calls you, do you really have to listen, right? Then you know, what's the point, right? So there's that. And of course, like, when it comes to the pressure of protests, I mean, one, the person that you should really listen to on these matters is a Russian opposition leader and historian called Vladimir Kara-Murza. He's easy to find. He writes for Washington Post, I believe, and he's often on panels and stuff. And he often says that, you know, dictatorships, they don't collapse because of pressure from protesters necessarily. They collapse under the weight of their own mistakes. The current Russian regime has been making a lot of mistakes. But, of course, the Soviet Union collapsed because a guy like Gorbachev came in, saw that there were real problems, and said, we have to change things. We can't go on like this. We have to change things. Unfortunately, for Gorbachev, the system was just so rotten at that point that once you start changing things, everything fell apart. Putin is not Gorbachev. He certainly is not a guy. He got a lot of his lessons from the Gorbachev period. And the lessons he took is, like, don't start changing things, because then everything might fall apart on you. And we don't want that. So he's certainly not a person who looks at the situation in Russia and says, we cannot go on like this. He thinks he definitely can. So he has to be proven wrong, basically. And the question is, like, how can the people prove him wrong? And what can we do to support them?
Yeah, well, Putin now, I guess, looking back on history, it's been so long in power, it's hard for me to remember Russia without Putin. I guess now he's been president since 2000, if I recall correctly, if I read that in the media right. So he's been now in power in two decades. What has been the legacy of Putin? Has his rule seen, has Russia prospered under Putin? I mean, you mentioned that. Of course, Russia is still tied to oil prices a lot. That's the key sort of driver of the economy. And now with new energy sources like fracking and so forth, oil prices have dropped. But has Putin then been able to maintain his popularity by, say, an improved economy and other improvements in Russia?
Not really. Most of this vast wealth that started coming his way in the early 2000s because of high oil prices have been squandered on the corruption, basically. I mean, there was a report from the Atlantic Council really that came out recently showing that Russia has the largest sum of money hidden abroad than any country. It's like over $1 trillion. It's both highest in absolute and as a percentage of GDP. That's like money that could be used to help the country, to help the people, which has been taken abroad by mostly by Putin and his cronies. And that's like, those are squandered resources that could have been used to develop Russia. His legacy would be basically be one of lost opportunities, where we desperately tried to delay a democratic transformation in Russia and to make it a better country for its people. This dark money that's hidden abroad, like what I ended with the previous segment was like, how can we help the Russian people fight the Putin regime? The best way is to go after the money, because like that's what keeps the regime alive. It's this money hidden in other countries. That's what finances things like this palace and the wars that Putin is fighting, by the way. So find that dark money, try to shut down the shell companies, all these dark bank accounts where these people hide these bank this money without asking any questions. Kick out a lot of these oligarchs. They do fancy vacations and shopping sprees in Western countries. They keep their kids in Western schools. If we shut down this money flow, then that will be a serious damage to the regime, and that is going to help the Russian people stand up to Putin. It's also very important to make sure that money then goes back into Russia, because it's stolen. Basically, it's stolen from the people of Russia and it belongs to them, not to the regime.
That's interesting. I didn't realize Russia ranked that high in corruption. I guess it reminds me of, say, for example, the Palestinian Authority, that they've received all this aid money, but apparently, you know, most of it's just gone into either corruption for, you know, dictators like Mahmoud Abbas, or for that matter, supporting jihadist terrorists, so just squandering on that, whereas the common Palestinians just live poorly. You said about $1 trillion abroad. Well, what other measures along with that can Western countries pursue in order to promote democratic liberal reform in Russia?
Well, the one important thing is, of course, to make our support for democracy and democracy movements a priority again. We used to be very good at that. There are plenty of people in Russia who are for that and would like to see us speak up about it as we're doing that right now. That's pretty good. But words are words. Like it's important thing that we coordinate this with our key allies and partners around the world, and we have a lot of them. Do not like keep the dissidents in your mind when you discuss things with the Putin regime. Recently, be able to walk and chew gum at the same time when we're talking about things like START and arms control. We have to be able to do that without forfeiting the rights and of the opposition and support of the people. Another thing is like something like cybersecurity, for example. If we look at the SolarWinds attack, I mean, we should be able to show to the Putin regime that two can play this game. We are just as good at this that they are. Again, coordinating with the allies on that one. And for instance, the palace video shows that there's plenty of stuff out there that the Russian regime would like to keep hiding, right? We can help out on bringing some of those bad things to light, bad things for them, that is. And also, like, we used to be good at messaging. You know, we had stuff like Voice of America, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. We dismantled a lot of our information agency after the end of the Cold War because we were like, oh, you know, job done, you know, fixed. We're good. We won. It's over. But of course, Russia didn't think it was over. The Vladimir Putin was like, okay, I've lost this battle, but I'm going to come back and win the war. So, you know, revamp these channels that we had, that there is a demand for that in Russia. Of course, the Russian government is going to label them as foreign agents and, you know, all that stuff, but they do that anyway. So, we don't have to, that's just the standard Russian propaganda that's been around forever. So that's that shouldn't be a concern. But also, like, and I think that this is important with NATO. They're recently, you know, beefing up. I would say, like, sort of at the final point, like beefing up the defenses. Because one thing that we know is that the regimes that start to get desperate, they can get aggressive. A lot of people believe that, you know, Putin's actions against Ukraine were taken in a situation where his popularity was starting to drop. So, you know, he started to, you know, try to cover that up with foreign adventures, and same thing in Syria in many ways. So, you know, be aware that, like, if you if he feels cornered, he might lash out, right? And so be, you know, make sure that the defenses of NATO are what they should be, again, in coordination with the allies. Unfortunately, the only, you know, bottom line is the thing that we needs to be done by about Russia right now is containment. We got that right in the Cold War. Containment worked, and containment is what we have to do with this right now. There is no, we're not going to be able to, you know, press a button and fix things with Russia. We're not going to be able to, you know, no new resets or special envoys are going to change anything of this. What needs to be done is just understand that we have a problem with Russia as long as Vladimir Putin is in power, and, you know, just accept that and contain it.
Well, looking perhaps maybe on that, briefly reviewing past American administrations, which administrations have been best on Russia since the end of the Cold War?
Oh, that's a good question. most of them have unfortunately made the mistake of, you know, coming in there and trying to reset things with Russia and hoping that Russia is somehow going to, you know, transform into a Western country just because we want them to. There were many mistakes during the Clinton period that mainly focused, the mistakes during the Clinton period were mainly on that we thought we put too much faith in Boris Yeltsin as a person. We thought that he was going to be a successful reformer, and he did change a lot of things in Russia for the better, but he failed ultimately as a reformer to take the steps of democracy. And I think fortunately the Clinton administration put a little bit too much faith in him. The good thing was that Clinton did do the NATO expansion, which in hindsight was an excellent idea, because if we hadn't done that, then basically half of Europe would be in the same situation that Ukraine is in today. As for George Bush, the main problem there was that we allowed Russia to get away with a lot of bad things in exchange for them sort of giving this tacit support to the war on terror, I think. There was a time when, you know, when Russia was like, oh yeah, sure, you know, you can, you know, you can fly over, use bases here from Afghanistan, just let us, you know, let us do what we want to do in Chechnya. I mean, we know sort of what that ended up in. I think the main mistake with the Obama administration was, of course, the reset. And going back to what I said before about NATO, I mean, one of my biggest beefs with the Obama administration's foreign policy is the fact of how reluctant they were to use power. I mean, as the United States, as a superpower, we have to be, it can't just be soft power. We have to be prepared to use hard power as well. There's a very good example of this is when Russia invaded Ukraine, when John Kerry, who was then Secretary of State, said that they're sort of using 19th century thinking in the 21st century. And I was like, and I heard that, I was like, well, that's true, yes. However, you're sort of implying that Russia believes in 21st century thinking. And I was like, well, why would we assume that? Like, it's obvious that they don't, right? So the problem is here, you're assuming that the other side shares your values. Well, when they don't share your values, you know, you can't expect them to behave the way you want to do just because you say that, oh, we live in the 21st century. It doesn't work that way. So, you know, that was the main problem with that. As for President Trump, I mean, I know that in a lot of the foreign policy circles, I mean, it's sort of fashionable to, you know, to dismiss Trump outright. I would say there are some nuggets when it comes to the Russia policy, especially when we're talking about being prepared to use sanctions. But the problem, I think, there very much it was not coordinated with the allies. It was often used crudely and, you know, without a particularly good strategic mind and idea for what it is that we wanted to do. We are never as effective alone as we are if we work together with others. That's one of the main. We have many Trump cards against Putin. We often say that Putin plays a weak hand. Well, and we have a strong hand. One of the strengths that we have versus Russia is the fact that we have friends and allies. Russia doesn't. Russia doesn't have friends and allies. They have client states, countries like Belarus that are basically held captive by them. They don't have broad alliances like NATO, like we do.
Well,
as for the incoming Biden administration, I mean, in many ways, you know, Joe Biden, he knows about Europe. He cares about Europe. Like, that's good. I would just hope that he, you know, he looks back at these past mistakes and doesn't repeat them.
Indeed. Yeah, we'll have to see what comes in this new Biden administration. Well, Aaron Korwoff from the McCain Institute, I thank you for joining me, Andrew Herod, on another episode of Conservative Casual Friday. And I hope our listeners will tune in next week as we discuss current events for conservatives and others. Thank you very much, Aaron Korov, for discussing Alexei Navalny and Russia's political future.
Thank you very much for having me.
All right, excellent.